assembled. Covered with a fastidiously elaborate frieze, the 12-foot gateway focuses the visitor's eye on the image of a single deity, whose figure projects from the lintel, the staff god. Today, the gateway of the sun is the postcard emblem of Tiwanaku. During the winter solstice, June in South America, hundreds of camera-toting European and American tourists wait on Kalasasaya through the entire freezing night for the sunrise, which is supposed to shine through the gateway on that date alone. Guides in traditional costume explain that the reliefs on the lintel form an intricate astronomical calendar that may have been brought to Earth by alien beings. To keep themselves warm during the inevitable longueurs, visitors sing songs of peace and harmony in several languages. Invariably, the spectators are stunned when the first light of sunrise appears well to the side of the gateway. Only afterward do they discover that the portal is not in its original location, and may have had nothing to do with astronomy or calendars. If those tourists had come to Tiwanaku at its height, walking through the miles of raised fields surrounding it to the city's carefully fitted stone walls, they would have been delighted by its splendor. But it might also have seemed curiously incomplete, with half the city falling down and in need of repairs, and the other half under construction. Modern drawings of ancient cities tend to show them at an imagined apogee, the great monuments all splendidly arrayed together, perfect as architectural models. But this is not what Tiwanaku looked like, nor even what it was meant to look like, according to Isbell and Vranich. From the very beginning, the two men wrote in 2004, the city was partly in ruins, intentionally so, because the fallen walls bequeathed on Tiwanaku the authority of the past. Meanwhile, other parts of the city were constantly enveloped in construction projects, which testified to the continued wealth and vitality of the state. Sometimes these projects acquired construction materials by cannibalizing old monuments, thereby hastening the process of creating ruins. In the Andean tradition, labor was probably contributed by visiting work parties. Periodically, ritual feasts that included much smashing of pottery interrupted the hubbub of construction. But it always continued. They build their monuments as if their intent was never to finish them, the Spanish academic Paulo de Ondegardo marveled in 1571. Exactly right, Isbell and Vranich said. Completion was not the object. The goal was a constant buzz of purposeful activity. As our hypothetical modern visitors wandered through the hurly-burly of construction and deconstruction, they might have felt that despite the commotion, something was missing. Unlike Western cities, Tiwanaku had no markets, no bazaars full of shouting, bargaining, conniving entrepreneurs, no street displays of produce, pottery, and plonk, no jugglers and mimes trying to attract crowds, no pickpockets. In Africa, Asia, and Europe, Collada wrote, a city was a place of meeting and of melding for many different kinds of people, through trade and exchange, through buying and selling of every conceivable kind. The city was made and remade. Tiwanaku was utterly different. Andean societies were based on the widespread exchange of goods and services, but kin and government, not market forces, directed the flow. The citizenry grew its own food and made its own clothes, or obtained them through their lineages, or picked them up in government warehouses. And the city, as Collada put it, was a place for symbolically concentrating the political and religious authority of the elite. Other Andean cities, Wari among them, shared this quality, but Tiwanaku carried it to an extreme. Tiwanaku has been excavated for a century, and the more archaeologists delve into it, the less there seems to be. To Vranich, the capital's lack of resemblance to European imperial cities extends well beyond the absence of marketplaces. Far from being the powerful administrative center envisioned by earlier researchers, he says, Tiwanaku was a combination of the Vatican and Disneyland, a religious show capital with a relatively small population, almost a staff, that attracted pilgrims by the thousand. Like the tourists at the solstice today, visitors came to this empire of appearances to be dazzled and awed. In the central city, buildings and monuments went up and down, at an incredible rate, Vranich told me at Tiwanaku, where he had been working since 1996. Nothing ever got finished completely because they were just concerned with the facades. They had to keep changing the exhibits to keep the crowds coming. The encounter between Tiwanaku and Wari at Cerro Baul seems to have gone remarkably smoothly. At any rate, a study of more than 1,000 Wari and Tiwanaku graves found no evidence of the trauma associated with violence. Instead, the two societies split the region between them. Wari camped atop Cerro Baul and a neighboring hillock, Cerro Mahia. Between them was a steep valley with Tiwanaku settlements scattered throughout. Because Wari and Tiwanaku pottery differed, Williams and Nash have been able to map which group lived in which neighborhood by the distribution of ceramic fragments. The Wari Canal provided drinking water, but had to pass through Tiwanaku territory at the base of Cerro Baul. Tiwanaku let the water through, but took enough to irrigate more than 700 acres of terraces. At the same time, Wari and Tiwanaku kept themselves separate. Although they shared resources, there is little evidence that people from one culture visited the other often, or had friendships across the political lines. Wari homes were furnished with Wari goods, Tiwanaku homes, Tiwanaku goods. Despite living next to each other, people continued to speak their different languages and wear their different clothing, and look for inspiration and instruction from their different capitals. The social science word for such intermingling without intermixing is interdigitization. For two centuries at Cerro Baul, Wari and Tiwanaku were like people in parallel worlds, sharing the same time and space, but implacably separate from each other. It is a small reminder that Indians were neither the peaceful, love-thy-neighbor types envisioned by some apologists, or the brutal, ceaselessly aggressive warriors decried by some political critics. The end came in about 800 AD, Williams told me. He was part of a Peruvian-American team that in 2005 reconstructed Cerro Baul's last days. As many as 28 high-ranking nobles and priests gathered in the Wari colony's biggest palace for a final feast at a great reception hall, 30 feet on a side, each wall lined with a stone-faced bench. The chamber opened onto what the archaeologists believed was likely the chief executive's office for conducting statecraft, the Andean equivalent of the Oval Office in the White House. To judge by the scattered food remains, the goodbye party was a Rabelaisian affair, with platters of llama, alpaca, vizcacha, Andean hare, and 7 types of fish, all washed down with fresh chicha. This last being served in huge ceremonial mugs, many heraldically decorated, that held up to a half a gallon apiece of brew. At the end, the drunken crew staggered through the palace, smashing the crockery and setting the whole place afire. It looks like they really had a wild time of it, William said. Last to go was the Chicha Brewery with its elite female staff. The lords torched the thatched milling room and then threw their great mugs into the flames. Later, when the embers had cooled, archaeologists wrote, 6 necklaces of shell and stone were placed atop the ashes in a final act of reverence. The retreat was part of a general fall. Tiwanaku may have declined first, leading Wari to shut down its embassy in Cerro Baul. Or perhaps Wari was pulling back for its own internal reasons. Both declines have been laid to drought, but this is contested. For one thing, Wari had already survived drought. As for Tiwanaku, Vranich said, how much would drought matter to Disneyland? Its ability to retain its audience would be far more important. The successors to both Wari and Tiwanaku combined the former's organizational skills and the latter's sense of design and razzle-dazzle. First came Chimor, Then the greatest empire ever seen in Peru, spread at its greatest extent over 700 miles of the coastline, Chimor was an ambitious state that grew maize and cotton by irrigating almost 50,000 acres around the Moche River. All of modern Peru only reached that figure in 1960. A destructive El Niño episode in about 1100 AD made irrigation impossible for a while. In response, the government forced gangs of captive laborers to build a 53-mile, masonry-lined canal to channel water from the Chicama River in the next valley to the north to farmland in the Moche Valley. The canal was a flop. Some parts ran uphill, apparently because of incompetent engineering, and the rest lost 9/10 of its water to evaporation and seepage. Some archaeologists believe that the canal was never meant to function. It was a PR exercise, they say. A Potemkin demonstration by the Chimor government that it was actively fighting El Niño. When the bad weather ended, Chimor looked outside its borders. Armies went out and returned victorious to Chanchan, the Chimor capital. A seaside metropolis with a dense center that covered 4 square miles. Dominated by 9 high-walled imperial palace tombs and 5 cathedral-like ceremonial complexes, the city was both exemplary in its grandeur and oddly empty, because its streets were restricted to the elite. Commoners were barred, except for a few specialized technicians and craft workers. Each palace was hundreds of feet on a side, and many were 3 stories tall. They were filled with storage space. Living quarters were almost an afterthought. Their great beams adorned with splendidly worked gold and silver. The huge structures were jammed together around the center of town, like people huddling in the shelter of an awning. Chanchan suffered a palace surfeit because dead rulers were regarded as divine figures. As with the Inca, the king's mummified bodies continued to live opulently in their own homes and could not be displaced. Indeed, the mummies were necessary presences at important state occasions. As a result, each new ruler had to build his own palace and acquire the riches necessary to maintain it till the end of time. The system almost guaranteed imperial ambitions and exuberant construction plans. The biggest of Chan Chan's surviving palaces may have belonged to Minchacaman, the 11th king in the Chimor dynasty, according to one Spanish account, who reputedly conquered much of the coastline. Minchacaman was a powerful figure who could have taken over even more land than he did. Unfortunately for him, he lived at the same time that a previously little-known group, the Inca, acquired a new ruler, Pachacuti. In about 1450, the Inca army, led by Cuapac Yupanqui, Pachacuti's brother, besieged the city-state of Cajamarca in the foothills east of Chimor. Cajamarca's leader had allied himself with Minchacaman, who rushed to his aid with an army. He does not seem to have known what he was in for, possibly because he viewed the Inca as a gang of rustic thugs. Cuapac Yupanqui awaited him in an ambush. Minchacaman and his army were forced to flee as Cajamarca fell to the Inca. Cuapac Yupanqui covered himself with so much glory that when he returned home to Cusco, his brother, sensing future trouble, promptly executed him. A decade or so later, in 1463, if Spanish chronicles are correct, the emperor sent out another army led by his son and designated successor, Tupa Inca Yupanqui. By that time, nobody thought of the Incas as hicks. Tupa Inca descended the Moche River and paralyzed Chimor's defenses by the simple expedient of threatening to destroy its water supply. Minchacaman was captured, taken to Cusco, and forced to watch Tupa Inca's victory celebration. Chimor's conquerors were quick studies. Liking the courtly magnificence of Chanchan, they hauled away what they could and, more important, forced the city's gold, silver, and gem workers to accompany them to Cusco. They were instructed to transform the city into a new Chanchan, only more impressive. 7 decades later, when Pizarro held his victory celebration in Cusco, it was equal in grandeur to any city in Europe. Making the Huaca. Jonathan Haas and Winifred Creamer took me to Caballete, a narrow, dusty bowl, perhaps half a mile long and a quarter mile wide, a few miles up from the Fortaleza River from the Peruvian coast. At the mouth of the bowl were three mounds in a rough semicircle that faced a fourth mound. In front of one mound, like a 1/8 scale model of Stonehenge, was a ragged circle of waka, sacred stones. Not far from the waka, looters had dug up an ancient graveyard, pulling out the bodies and unwinding them from their sheets in a search for gold and jewels. When they didn't find any, they threw the bones down in disgust. In a square perhaps 50 yards on a side, the ground was carpeted with broken human bones and scraps of thousand-year-old fabric. We walked a little further and were greeted by a curious sight. Skulls from the cemetery gathered into several small piles. Around them were beer cans, cigarette butts, patent medicine bottles, half-burned photographs, and candles shaped like naked women. These last had voodoo pins stuck in their heads and vaginas. Local people came to these places at night and either dug for treasure or practiced witchcraft, Haas said. In the harsh afternoon light, they seemed to me tacky and sad. I imagined that the families of the people who had been buried at Caballete so long ago would have been outraged if they could have known what would happen to the bodies of their loved ones. But then it occurred to me that my views may not have been shared by either the present or the past inhabitants of Norte Chico. I had no idea what people in Huari or Chimor would have thought of the scene before me. So far in this section, I've mainly described the economic and political history of Andean Indians. But people live also in the realm of the affective and aesthetic. That's why they bury bodies and sometimes dig them up and pour love potions on them. Despite all the knowledge gained by scientists in the last few decades, the emotional realm remains much harder to reach. An obvious example on the southern coast is the Nazca, famous for the huge patterns they set into the ground. Figures of animals and plants, almost 1,000 geometric symbols, arrow straight lines many miles long. What were they for? Peruvian anthropologist Toribio Mejia Sespe first brought these famous drawings to the attention of the outside world in 1927. 4 decades later, the Swiss writer Erich von Däniken set off an international furor by claiming that the Nazca Indians could not have made these symbols because they were too big for such primitive people to construct, and because they are visible only from the air. Instead, he said, the giant figures were landing signals for space travelers. The whole plane was a sort of gigantic extraterrestrial airport. Expanded in a series of best-selling books, this notion turned the lines into a major tourist attraction. Exasperated scientists pointed out that, A, small groups could have constructed the images by moving the dark surface stone to expose the lighter-colored earth beneath, and B, the Nazca did not have to see the figures to experience them, for they can be understood by walking the lines, which it is believed the Indians did. The prevailing theory today is that the straight lines mapped out the area's many underground faults, which channel water. But nobody knows why the Nazca made the animal and plant figures, which seem less likely to have a direct function. What were the Nazca thinking as they created them? How did they feel when they walked them? To this day, the answers remain frustratingly far away. Or consider the Moche, leaders of a military state that overran much of the northern coast, submerging the identities of its victims in its own. Huaca del Sol, the Moche capital, contains the largest adobe structure in the Andes, still hauntingly evocative despite centuries of systematic looting. Unwilling to laboriously dig their way through the palace's tombs, the Spaniards diverted the Moche River through it, washing out the riches in orthodox Augean stable style. Contemporary thieves have contented themselves with picks and shovels. After about 300 AD, Moche artists confined themselves to perhaps half a dozen subjects, painting stories of supernatural figures on pottery and murals with ever more naturalistic technique. actors reenacted the same stories in grand pageants and ritual celebrations. Individual combat is a common theme. Losers were formally stripped of their garments and forced to parade naked. Another oft-repeated tale involves the death and burial of a regal figure. Many of the people in the paintings are sharply individuated. Great effort has gone into studying the Moche. But as Mosley says, their identities and motives often remain elusive. The Moche polity broke up around 800 AD, taking with it our chance to understand. One of the few moments when I imagined I could encompass something of the inner lives of these long-ago people occurred in Chavín de Huántar, a city of several thousand people that existed between 800 BC and 200 AD. Its most important feature, a ceremonial temple shaped in a Norte Chico style U, was a masterpiece of architectural intimidation. Using a network of concealed vents and channels, priests piped loud, roaring sounds at those who entered the temple. Visitors walked up three flights of stairs, growls echoing around them, and into a long, windowless passageway. At the end of the corridor, in a cross-shaped room that flickered with torchlight, was a 15-foot-high stone figure with a cat-like face, taloned fingers, fierce tusks, and Medusa hair. Nobody today is sure of the god's identity. Immediately above it, hidden from visitors' eyes, sat a priestly functionary who provided the god's voice. After the long, torch-lit approach, walking straight into the gaze of the snarling deity, mysterious bellows reverberating off the stone, the oracular declamation from above must have been spine-chilling. Most of the complex is open to tourists. Many of the sculptures have been put into museums. Others presumably have been looted. Yet walking into the temple still felt to me like entering a mountain of solid rock. Over and over again, Andean stories tell of spirits embodied in stones and giants transformed into natural features. The landscape has an intricate, numinous geography. It is charged with meaning that must be respected and heeded. The earth, in this view, is not something to be left alone. The waka that litter Peruvian anthropological sites are often partly sculpted, as if they had needed some human attention to manifest their sacred qualities. Thus, the human-made tunnels into the temple were part of what made it embody the power of a mountain. As I walked down the dimly lighted corridor toward where the torch-lit deity had stood, my fingers ran along the walls created by Chavín craftworkers. They were fit beautifully into place, and as cold and hard as the mountains they came from. But they did not gain their power without my hand to close the circuit. The natural world is incomplete without the human touch. Part 3. Landscape with Figures. Chapter 8. Made in America. Entering the Water. At some point, Choctolquichac must have realized that January 14th, 378 AD, would be his last day on Earth. The king of Mutal, the biggest and most cosmopolitan city-state in the Maya world, he lived and worked in a sprawling castle a few hundred yards away from the great temples at the city's heart. Now known as Tikal, the ruins of Mutal have become an international tourist attraction. Audience seekers entered the castle through a set of three richly carved doors in its eastern wall. Inside was a receiving room where petitioners waited for the king's attention. An inner portal led to a torchlit chamber where Choctolquichac, flanked by counselors and minions, reclined on an ornate bench. On that bench is, quite possibly, where he met his fate. Like most Maya rulers, Choctolquichac spent a lot of his time luxuriating in his court while dwarf servants attended to his whims and musicians played conch shells and wooden trumpets in the background. But he also excelled at such regal duties as performing ritual public dances, sending out trade expeditions in search of luxury goods, and fighting wars. A celebratory stela has Choctolquichac personally stomping a manacled POW. In another portrait, a bas-relief, the king is depicted as an alert man with a long breech clout and a jeweled mass of necklaces, bracelets, anklets, and pendants clicking and clattering about his person. Towering a foot over his skull was an elaborate headdress in the shape of a bird of prey, complete with swirling plumage. Like most Maya art, the portrait is too stylized to regard as a naturalistic rendering. Nonetheless, it effectively makes its point. Choctaw-Quechac was a major historical figure. By combining scraps of data on several inscriptions, archaeologists have calculated that Choctaw-Quechac probably acceded to the throne in 360 AD. At the time, the Maya realm consisted of 60 or so small, jostling statelets scattered across what is now northern Belize and Guatemala and the Yucatan Peninsula. Mutal was older and wealthier than most, but otherwise not strikingly different. Choctaw-Quechac changed that. During the 18 years of his reign, the city acquired diplomatic stature and commercial clout. Its population grew to perhaps 10,000, and it established trade contacts throughout Mesoamerica. As it prospered, Mutal attracted considerable attention, which, in the end, may have been the king's undoing. Marching toward him that January day was an armed force from Teotihuacan, 630 miles to the west. Already in control of most of central Mexico, Teotihuacan was looking for new lands to dominate. Leading the expedition was one Siaj Kak, apparently a trusted general or counselor to the ruler of Teotihuacan. Four Maya cities along Siaj Kak's path recorded his progress in murals, panel paintings, and stelae. Texan images depict the Teotihuacanos as gaudily martial figures with circular mirrors strapped to their backs and squared-off helmets sweeping protectively in front of the jaw. They were bare-chested, but wore fringed leggings and heavy-shell necklaces and high-strapped sandals. In their hands were atlatls and obsidian darts to throw with them. Painted panels in one city show Maya soldiers in jaguar uniforms rushing to attack the visitors. But in fact, it seems unlikely that any of the small settlements between Teotihuacan and Mutal would have dared to harass them. No detailed description of the encounter between Siaj Kak and Choctaw-Quechac exists, but it is known that discussion did not go on for long. They two men met on January 14th, 378 AD. On that same day, Choctaw-Quechac entered the water, according to an account carved on a later stela. The Maya saw the afterworld as a kind of endless, foggy sea. Entering the water was thus a euphemism on the order of, passed on to a better place. Readers of the stela would understand that Choctaw-Quechac's old heart had quietly stopped beating after Siaj Kak, or one of his troops, slipped a blade into it. Likely the rest of his family perished, as well as anyone else who objected. In any case, no one seems to have complained when Siaj Kak established a new dynasty at Mutal by installing the son of his Teotihuacan master on the vacant throne. Choctaw-Quechac's death began a tumultuous period in Mesoamerican history. The new Teotihuacan-backed dynasty at Mutal drove the city to further heights of power and prestige. Inevitably, its expansion was resented. A northern city-state, Kan, now known as Calakmul, conscripted an army from its client states and launched a series of attacks. The ensuing strife lasted 150 years, spread across the Maya heartland, and resulted in the pillage of a dozen city-states, among them both Mutal and Kan. After suffering repeated losses, Mutal unexpectedly defeated the superior forces of Kan, possibly killing its king to boot. The beaten, humiliated Kan lost the support of its vassals and was reduced to penury. Mutal once again reclaimed its heritage from imperial Teotihuacan, but its triumph, though long sought, was short-lived. In one of archaeology's most enduring mysteries, Maya civilization crumbled around it within a century. After a final flash of imperial splendor, the city joined Khan and most central Maya cities in obscurity and ruin. By about 900 AD, both Nutal and Khan stood almost empty, along with dozens of other Maya cities. And soon, even the few people who still lived there had forgotten their imperial glories. Getting along with nature. Why did the Maya abandon all their cities? No words more calculated to strike dismay in the hearts of Maya archaeologists. The Maya archaeologist David Webster confessed in 2002. Webster, a researcher at Pennsylvania State University, admitted that during his incautious younger years, he often told fellow airplane passengers that he was flying to work at some ancient Maya center. Then, with utter predictability, would come the dreaded question. Nowadays, older and wiser, I usually mutter something vague about business and then bury my nose in the airline magazine. One reason Webster avoided the question is its scope. Asking what happened to the ancient Maya is like asking what happened in the Cold War. The subject is so big that one hardly knows where to begin. At the same time, the very sweep is why the Maya collapse has fascinated archaeologists since the 1840s, when the outside world first learned of the abandoned cities in Yucatan. Today, we know that the fall was not quite as rapid, dramatic, and widespread as earlier scholars believed. Nevertheless, according to Billy Lee Turner, a geographer at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, it was unique in world history. Cultures rise and fall, but there is no other known time when a large-scale society disintegrated and was replaced by nothing. When the Roman Empire fell apart, he said, Italy didn't empty out, no cities, no major societies, for more than 1,000 years. But the Maya heartland did just that. What happened? In the 1930s, Sylvanus G. Morley of Harvard, probably the most celebrated Mayanist of his day, espoused what is still the best-known theory. The Maya collapsed because they overshot the carrying capacity of their environment. They exhausted their resource base, began to die of starvation and thirst, and fled their cities en masse, leaving them as silent warnings of the perils of ecological hubris. When Morley proposed his theory, it was little more than a hunch. Since then, though, scientific measurements, mainly of pollen in lake sediments, have shown that the Maya did cut down much of the region's forest, using the wood for fuel and the land for agriculture. The loss of tree cover would have caused large-scale erosion and floods. With their fields disappearing beneath their feet and a growing population to feed, Maya farmers were forced to exploit ever more marginal terrain with ever more intensity. The tottering system was vulnerable to the first good push, which came in the form of a century-long dry spell that hit Yucatan between 800 and 900 AD. Social disintegration followed soon thereafter. Recounted in numberless articles and books, the Maya collapse has become an ecological parable for green activists. Along with Pleistocene overkill, it is a favorite cautionary tale about surpassing the limits of nature. The Maya were able to build a complex society capable of great cultural and intellectual achievements, but they ended up destroying what they created. Clive Ponting wrote in his influential Green History of the World, 1991. Following the implications of the Maya fall, he asked, are contemporary societies any better at controlling the drive toward ever greater use of resources and heavier pressure on the environment? Is humanity too confident about its ability to avoid ecological disaster? The history of these Indians, Ponting and others have suggested, has much to teach us today. Curiously, though, environmentalists also describe Native American history as embodying precisely the opposite lesson. How to live in a spiritual balance with nature. Bookstore shelves groan beneath the weight of titles like Sacred Ecology, Guardians of the Earth, Mother Earth Spirituality, and Indigenous Traditions and Ecology, the Interbeing of Cosmology and Community. So strongly endorsed is this view of Native Americans that checklists exist to judge whether books correctly depict their environmental values. The Native Culture's Authenticity Guideline, for instance, assesses the portrayal of the five great values shared by all the major Native cultures, including, one assumes, the Maya, one of which is getting along with nature, respecting the sacred natural harmony of and with nature. To be historically accurate, according to the guidelines, major Native cultures must be shown displaying a proper reverence for the gift of life. Indians as poster children for eco-catastrophe, Indians as green role models. The two images contradict each other less than they seem. Both are variants of Holmberg's mistake, the idea that Indians were suspended in time, touching nothing and untouched themselves, like ghostly presences on the landscape. The first two sections of this book were devoted to two different ways that researchers have recently repudiated this perspective. I showed that they have raised their estimates of indigenous populations in 1492, and the reasons for it, and then why most researchers now believe that Indian societies have been here longer than had been imagined, and grew more complex and technologically accomplished than previously thought. In this section, I treat another facet of Holmberg's mistake, the idea that Native cultures did not or could not control their environment. The view that Indians left no footprint on the land is an obvious example. That they marched heedlessly to tragedy is a subtler one. Both depict indigenous people as passively accepting whatever is meted out to them, whether it is the fruits of undisturbed ecosystems or the punishment for altering them. Native Americans' interactions with their environments were as diverse as Native Americans themselves, but they were always the product of a specific historical process. Occasionally, researchers can detail that process with some precision, as in the case of the Maya. More often, one can see only the outlines of history, as in the reconfiguration of the eastern half of the United States. These two paradigmatic examples are the subjects I turn to now. In both, Indians worked on a very large scale, transforming huge swaths of the landscape for their own ends. Sifting through the evidence, it is apparent that many, though not all Indians, were superbly active land managers. They did not live lightly on the land. And they do have lessons to teach us. But they are not what are commonly supposed. Fireplace. Adrian van der Donck was a lawyer who in 1641 transplanted himself to the Hudson River Valley, then part of the Dutch colony of New Nederland. He became a kind of prosecutor and bill collector for the Dutch West India Company, which owned and operated the colony as a private fiefdom. Whenever possible, van der Donck ignored his duties and tramped around the forests and valleys upstate. He spent a lot of time with the Haudenosaunee, whose insistence on personal liberty fascinated him. "They were," he wrote, "all free by nature and will not bear any domineering or lording over them." When a committee of settlers decided to complain to the government about the Dutch West India Company's dictatorial behavior, it asked van der Donck, the only lawyer in New Amsterdam, to compose a protest letter and travel with it to The Hague. His letter set down the basic rights that, in his view, belonged to everyone on American soil. The first formal call for liberty in the colonies. It is tempting to speculate that van der Donck drew inspiration from the attitudes of the Haudenosaunee. The Dutch government responded to the letter by taking control of New Amsterdam from the Dutch West India Company and establishing an independent governing body in Manhattan, thereby setting into motion the creation of New York City. Angered by their loss of power, the company directors effectively prevented van der Donck's return for 5 years. While languishing in Europe, he wrote a nostalgic pamphlet extolling the land he had come to love. "Every fall," he remembered, "the Haudenosaunee set fire to the woods, plains, and meadows, to thin out and clear the woods of all dead substances and grass, which grow better the ensuing spring." At first, the wildfire had scared him, but over time, van der Donck had come to relish the spectacle of the yearly burning. Such a fire is a splendid sight when one sails on the Hudson and Mohawk rivers at night, while the forest is ablaze on both banks, he recalled. With the forest burning to the right and the left, the colonists' boats passed through a channel of fire, their passengers as goggle-eyed at the blaze as children at a video arcade. Fire and flames are seen everywhere and on all sides, a delightful scene to look on from afar. Von der Donk believed that North America was only several hundred miles across, and apparently assumed that all its inhabitants were exactly like the Haudenosaunee. He was wrong about the first belief, but in a sense correct about the second. From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Hudson's Bay to the Rio Grande, the Haudenosaunee and almost every other Indian group shaped their environment, at least in part, by fire. Early in the last century, ecologists discovered the phenomenon of succession, the more or less well-defined sequence by which ecosystems fill in open land. A textbook example occurred after the eruption in 1980 of Mount St. Helens in southern Washington state, which inundated more than 200 square miles with magma, volcanic ash, and mud. Surviving plants sprang quickly to life, sometimes resprouting within weeks. Then colonizing species like lupine appeared, preparing the ground for the return of the grasses. 15 years after the eruption, the ravaged slopes were dotted with trees and woody shrubs. Red alder, lodgepole pine, willow bush. Here and there gleamed the waxy red boles of madrone. Forest giants like hemlock, Douglas fir, and Sitka spruce waited in the wings. In the classic successional course, each suite of plants replaces its predecessor, until the arrival of the final, climax ecosystem, usually tall forest. If ecological succession were unstoppable, the continents would be covered by climax stage vegetation, a world of great trees, dark and silent. Early succession species would have vanished. Luckily for these species, succession is often interrupted. Nature does not move in lockstep. Windstorms, lightning fires, landslides, volcanic eruptions, and other natural calamities knock down trees and open up the forest, or prevent open country from turning into forest land. A few years or decades of tranquility may see grasses replaced by shrubs and trees, which are in turn flattened by a violent thunderstorm, permitting the grass to thrive again. After a while, the shrubs and trees return, only to be wiped out by a flood, and so on. Different types of disturbance shape different ecosystems. Floods in the Nile, landslides on the steep pitches of the Andes, hurricanes in the Yucatan Peninsula. For more than 10,000 years, most North American ecosystems have been dominated by fire. In the Greek myth of Prometheus, the gift of fire forever severs humankind from the natural world. The burning torch is the icon of the constructed and artificial. On the mundane, factual level, though, this resonant tale is wrong. Nature has always used fire as a mallet to beat landscapes into other forms. Prometheus only helped human beings to pick up the handle. The Earth, wrote the pioneering fire ecologist Edward V. Komarek, born in fire, baptized by lightning, since before life's beginning has been and is a fire planet. Set off by lightning, wildfires reset the ecological clock, dialing the array of plants and animals back a few successional stages. Fire benefits plants that need sunlight, while inhibiting those that love the cool gloaming of the forest floor. It encourages the animals that need those plants, even as it discourages others. In turn, predator populations rise and fall. In this way, fire regulates ecological character. Fire is a dominating factor in many, if not most, terrestrial landscapes. It has two main sources, lightning and Homo sapiens. In North America, lightning fire is most common in the Western Mountains. Elsewhere, though, Indians controlled it, at least until contact, and in many places long after. In the Northeast, Indians always carried a deerskin pouch full of flints, Thomas Morton reported in 1637, which they used to set fire of the country in all places where they come. The flints ignited torches, which were as important to the hunt as bows and arrows. Deer in the northeast, alligators in the Everglades, buffalo in the prairies, grasshoppers in the Great Basin, rabbits in California, moose in Alaska, all were pursued by fire. Native Americans made big rings of flame, Thomas Jefferson wrote, by firing the leaves fallen on the ground, which, gradually forcing animals to the center, they there slaughter them with arrows, darts, and other missiles. Not that Indians always used fire for strictly utilitarian purposes. At nightfall, tribes in the Rocky Mountains entertained the explorers, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, by applying torches to sap-dripping fir trees, which then exploded like Roman candles. Rather than domesticate animals for meat, Indians retooled ecosystems to encourage elk, deer, and bear. Constant burning of undergrowth increased the numbers of herbivores, the predators that fed on them, and the people who ate them both. Rather than the thick, unbroken, monumental snarl of trees imagined by Thoreau, the Great Eastern Forest was an ecological kaleidoscope of garden plots, blackberry rambles, pine barrens, and spacious groves of chestnut, hickory, and oak. The first Europeans in Ohio found woodlands that resembled English parks. They could drive carriages through the trees. 15 miles from shore in Rhode Island, Giovanni da Verrazzano found trees so widely spaced that the forest could be penetrated even by a large army. John Smith claimed to have ridden through the Virginia forest at a gallop. Incredible to imagine today, bison occurred from New York to Georgia. A creature of the prairie, bison was imported to the East by Native Americans along a path of indigenous fire. As they changed enough forest into fallows for it to survive far outside its original range. When the Haudenosaunee hunted these animals, the historian William Cronin observed, they were harvesting a foodstuff which they had consciously been instrumental in creating. Few English observers could have realized this. People accustomed to keeping domesticated animals lacked the conceptual tools to recognize that the Indians were practicing a more distant kind of husbandry of their own. Note, though, that these weren't the huge herds of bison celebrated in the 19th century West. Because Indians liked to eat the animals, they took care to maximize the area in which they could be found. But they also hunted a lot of them, so they were relatively scarce across this range. If the species had been plentiful, people wouldn't have had to go to the trouble of burning the forest to encourage it. Indian fire had its greatest impact in the middle of the continent, which Native Americans transformed into a prodigious game farm. Most of Indiana and part of Illinois, for instance, was prairie or barrens when it was first surveyed in 1818-20. A 2009 study of surviving trees from the pre-European era showed that even in thickly forested areas, fires intense enough to scar trunks occurred, on average, every 2.82 years. Because lightning strikes in this area are usually accompanied by rain that would quickly extinguish any lightning fires, researchers from Southern Illinois University and Principia College wrote in 2010, nearly all of these early fires were likely due to human activity. Further west, the same burning occurred, but on even grander scale. Native Americans burned the Great Plains and Midwest prairies so much, and so often, that they increased their extent. In all probability, a substantial portion of the giant grassland celebrated by cowboys was established and maintained by the people who arrived there first. When Lewis and Clark headed west from St. Louis, wrote ethologist Dale Lott, they were exploring not a wilderness, but a vast pasture managed by and for Native Americans. In 1792, the surveyor, Peter Fidler, examined the plains of southern Alberta systematically, the first European to do so. Riding with several groups of Indians in high fire season, he spent days on end in a scorched land. Grass all burnt this day, he reported on November 12th. Not a single pine to be seen 3 days past. A day later, all burnt ground this day. A day later. The grass nearly burnt all along this day except near the lake. A month later. The grass is now burning with very great fury. Every fall and spring, and even in the winter when there is no snow, these large plains, either in one place or other, is constantly on fire. And when the grass happens to be long and the wind high, the sight is grand and awful, and it drives along with amazing swiftness. Fiddler acknowledged that the fires could be very dangerous, but understood their purpose. These fires burning off the old grass, he observed, in the ensuing spring and summer, makes excellent fine sweet feed for the horses and buffalo, etc. When Indian societies disintegrated from disease and mistreatment, forest invaded savanna in Wisconsin, Illinois, Kansas, Nebraska, Wyoming, and the Texas Hill Country. Europeans forgot what the landscape had looked like before and why. Captain John Palliser, traveling through the same lands as Fiddler 6 decades later, lamented the Indians' disastrous habit of setting the prairie on fire for the most trivial and worse than useless reasons. Afterward, even the memory of indigenous fire faded. By the 20th century, biologists were stoutly denying its existence. The open park-like woods seen by early settlers, Harvard naturalist Hugh Raup asserted in 1937, were not caused by fire. They have been from time immemorial, characteristic of vast areas in North America. Raup's summary description of the idea that they were due to regular, wide-scale Indian burning? Inconceivable. It is at least a fair assumption, a widely used college forestry textbook remarked in 1973, that no habitual or systematic burning was carried out by Indians. In the western United States, the geographer Thomas R. Vail wrote in 2002, the modest Indian population modified only a tiny fraction of the total landscape for their everyday living needs. Vail is in the minority now. Spurred in part by historians like Cronin, most scientists have changed their minds about Indian fire. Using clever laboratory techniques, they've convinced themselves that in most cases, the tribal lore and old chronicles were right all along. Indian embers were sparkling in the American night for centuries before the Sumerians climbed their ziggurats. Carrying their flints and torches, Native Americans were living in balance with nature. But they had their thumbs on the scale. Shaped for their comfort and convenience, the American landscape had come to fit their lives like comfortable clothing. It was a highly successful and stable system. If stable is the appropriate word for a regime that involves routinely enshrouding miles of countryside in smoke and ash, and it was a system that Indians were abandoning in ever-rising numbers at the time when Europeans came. 10,000 Mounds. Anyone who traveled up the Mississippi in 1100 AD would have seen it looming in the distance. A four-level earthen mound bigger than the Great Pyramid of Giza. Around it, like echoes, were as many as 120 smaller mounds, some topped by tall wooden palisades, which were in turn ringed by a network of irrigation and transportation canals. Carefully located fields of maize, and hundreds of wooden homes with mud and straw plastered floors, and high-peaked, deeply thatched roofs like those on traditional Japanese farms. Located near the confluence of the Missouri, Illinois, and Mississippi rivers, the Indian city of Cahokia was a busy port. Canoes flitted like hummingbirds across its waterfront. Traders bringing copper and mother-of-pearl from faraway places, hunting parties bringing such rare treats as buffalo and elk. Emissaries and soldiers in long vessels bristling with weaponry. Workers ferrying wood from upstream for the ever-hungry cook fires. The ubiquitous fishers with their nets and clubs. Covering 5 square miles and housing at least 15,000 people, Cahokia was the biggest concentration of people north of the Rio Grande until the 18th century. Away from the riverside, Cahokia was hardly less busy and imposing. Its focal point was the Great Mound, Monk's Mound, it is now called, named after a group of Trappists who lived nearby in the 18th and 19th centuries. Around its sides rushed a flow of men, their body paint and tattoos obscured by dust from the hardened, brick-like mud that lay underneath the entire city. Some built new mounds or maintained the old. Others hauled wood for fuel and houses, or carried water in leather pouches, or weeded the maize fields with stone hoes. Women carried sacks of woven mats, baskets of fish and produce, yowling children. Cook smoke chimneyed to the sky. Standards made of painted animal skins flapped everywhere. Anyone who has visited Siena or Venice knows how surprisingly noisy a city without engines can be. At peak times, given the right wind conditions, Cahokia must have been audible for miles. Monk's Mound opens onto a plaza 1,000 feet long. In its southwest corner is a pair of mounds, one conical, one square. One day I climbed up their grassy sides at sunset. Hardly any other visitors were there. The humped outline of the vast heap of earth emerged from the empty green like a powerful prairie ship. The sun was low, and the great mound was casting a shadow that looked long enough to reach the Allegheny Mountains. For a moment, I saw no sign of contemporary life. St. Louis, just across the river, had not yet switched on its lights. Around me was the Mound City, and nothing but the Mound City. To we moderns, the sensation of being in a constructed environment is so ubiquitous as to be invisible. In the cocoon of our strip malls and automobiles, we are like the fish that cannot feel the water through which they swim. In Cahokia's day, it was different. 1,000 years ago, it was the only place for 1,000 miles in which one could be completely enveloped in an artificial landscape. To visitors today, it seems obvious that Cahokia and the many other mound sites in the Midwest and Southeast are the remains of Indian settlements. It did not seem so clear in the past. 19th century writers attributed the mound complexes to, among others, the Chinese, the Welsh, the Phoenicians, the lost nation of Atlantis, and various biblical personages. A widely touted theory assigned authorship to Scandinavian emigres, who later picked up stakes, moved to Mexico, and became the Toltecs. The science fiction writer and archaeology buff, Robert Silverberg, devoted an entire entertaining book to the back and forth over the origin of the mounds, which intermittently preoccupied American intellectuals for a century. Thomas Jefferson removed a slice from a mound on his estate, examined the stratigraphic layers, and announced that Indians had made it. George Bancroft, one of the founders of American history, disagreed. The mounds, he wrote in 1840, were purely natural formations. Charitably, one could say that Bancroft was correct. Cahokia was a product of its geography, which in turn was a product of the Ice Age. When the glaciers melted, water gushed south, creating the Mississippi River and the Illinois and Missouri rivers that funnel into it. They met in a roil of water 80 miles wide. When the rivers receded, they exposed a wide strip of bottomland. Into this land, a group of Indians coalesced sometime before 800 AD. Nobody knows what these people called themselves or which language they spoke. They were not Cahokians. That name, itself a linguistic garble, comes from an unrelated group that migrated to the area almost 1,000 years later. Archaeologists are unlikely to find a better name, though. According to William Woods, the geographer and archaeologist at the University of Kansas, Monk's Mound completely covers whatever habitation these people had before they built Cahokia. To see the remaining traces of this early settlement, scientists would have to jack up the whole enormous pile and dig underneath. Almost all that can be known with certainty about this initial group is that it belonged to a diverse 4,000-year-old tradition characterized by the construction of large earthen mounds. Based around the Mississippi and its associated rivers, these societies scattered tens of thousands of mounds from southern Canada and the Great Plains, to the Atlantic coast and the Gulf of Mexico. They were especially concentrated in the Ohio Valley, but nearly as many are found in the Southeast.